new books off the press, Lucy's book and the Four Zinas. Those books are out there on the tables out there. By all means, please take a look at them and find out if you'd like to add them to your library. And then also we're told that Jen Shipp's book, Sojourner, it is, let's see, have we sold out there? If we haven't, we can make arrangements. They said that they would get an autographed copy for those who want a copy of Jan Shipp's book. So they'll make arrangements for that as well. So the audio tapes, the two new books, and Jan Shipp's books, that's our commercial message. Now it's my privilege and honor to welcome our next speaker today. It is not often that we at Sunstone get to listen to a speaker whose every public comment is tracked by the media. And it's often, not very often the case that we at Sunstone get to listen to a Sunstone speaker whose signature has appeared on all the United States currency at one time. So we are fortunate today to share an hour with Angela Bay Buchanan. Fortunate because, if I understand it, Bay, you have just come from an event where I think you were either the keynote speaker or the chairperson of the event. And after this event, she's running off to another event where she is someone of equal stature, and another event going on today. She was at one last night. We are very fortunate to have her and share her time today. Now, just one of Bay's full-time jobs is being the active parent of three active teenage boys, Tommy, Billy, and Stuart. When not at a track meet or an athletic event for one of her sons, Bay might be seen pulling together a Relief Society or Sunday school lesson, fulfilling one of her many church callings over the years. But Bay also has two or three full-time day jobs, depending upon how you measure these things. She is perhaps best known for her involvement in politics, which started very early in her life. She's once reported to have said that she was raised in a Nixon family, that being a Richard Nixon kind of family, but attended Catholic schools during the Kennedy era. So I think gave her a head start in the political debate and commentary. In the public limelight, Bay has been called many things. She has been called the campaign chairwoman for her brother's two presidential campaigns. She's been called a political talk show host for equal time on MSNBC. She's been called the United States Treasurer during the Reagan administration. She's been called a professor of mathematics and physics, I believe it is. She's been called a political commentator, and I'm pleased and honored to call her my friend and neighbor out in Oakton, Virginia. Will you please help me welcome Angela Bay Buchanan?
Thank you. I can say I'm delighted it's mixed company, or he may have continued to say she's been called. A whole lot of other things out there, not as nice as the ones that Kurtz just referred to. I should do a little editing of his introduction, though, in fairness. He uses the word active to describe my boys. That's a euphemism, as you all probably figured out. My one boy hangs out at his house, virtually lives there, and they know that active is a polite way of saying what he is. They are very, very energized children. I have three teenage boys. And when you heard I was doing something else this afternoon in equal stature, it's racing over to a track meet. There's nothing that you all haven't done and been there before. I want to see my son. He's a long-distance runner. And thank goodness his race is this afternoon rather than this morning, so I'll be able to see that as well. The many jobs that I have, I want you to know I also paint houses and dance, do anything at all, if it pays. I'm one of those political people that is most interested in the conversation as long as there's some type of remuneration at the end of that these days when you're raising those three boys. But no, I am been devoted to a cause my whole life, and that is what I have worked through in different capacities. I'm always close to the cause of which I believe. And so I have spent my life in politics. It's something I don't recommend. I have told my boys to stay clear of it, but knowing that I'm a mother saying that means that that's probably exactly so. So I've got to get smart here and try to drag them into it, and knowing then that I may accomplish my ultimate goal. But it is a tough and rugged business, and it's one of those things you don't plan ahead. You know, you don't go to college and say, I'm going to be involved in politics, I'm going to do this. It just kind of happens. And little by little, you're taken by it and caught up in it. But what I've been able to ask to talk about today is a little bit of the politics mixed with little Mormonism. My brother's keeper is a clever way of putting it, since it's my brother that ended up bringing me into this field. And let me start by a story that combines it all. Back in 1988, I was at the presidential convention for Republicans, where they were. Reagan had had his two terms, and Bush was being nominated. And the Nixon people were very active at the time. They were, you know, very enthused about Bush. And a lot of them were down there, the old Nixon people. And one of them decided to have a big party for the old Nixon guys. And it was a black tie dinner, about 100 sit down. And he and his wife were going to basically have almost a ceremony where they're getting married again that morning. And then they're going to have this big fun event with all their best friends. And I'm at a table with Secretary of Transportation from the to be. So I guess it was, you know, no, it must have been, it was the, yes, it was. He had been the Secretary of Transportation. These were my friend's days. And then there was a wife of one of the old Nixon people was at the table. We had 10 people at the table. And I was very good friends of this Secretary of Transportation, Drew Lewis. And so they had husbands and wives all mixed, you know, so they weren't sitting at the tables with each other. And we were having our normal political discussion, and somebody said, what do you think Bush will do for Supreme Court? And so I spoke up just to, I said, what do you think about Orrin Hatch? And they all looked at me. And, you know, most of them didn't say anything, or just continued the conversation. And this one lady said, that is never going to happen. He's a Mormon. And I just said, so I just continued eating. And decided, and I said, well, I don't know, you know, kind of, he's good, he's solid, he's great on the issues, he's a senator, he'll get confirmed, you know, through the natural, normal conversation, political points out. And she came back. There's no way we're putting a Mormon on the Supreme Court. So I finished my meal, decided just to back out of that one. And as they were bringing on the desserts, my friend Drew Lewis must have spent most of his steak thinking about this. And he decided now, 10 minutes later, to add to the conversation the fact that I was a Mormon. He said, you do know, Bay is a Mormon. And I'm like... And she looked at me and said, no, you are not. So I thought a moment, making certain I was sure of myself. And I said, oh, yes, I am. And she said, no, you're not. You're Catholic. I said, I'm not Catholic. I was Catholic. I'm a convert. I'm a Mormon. So then she continued to eat. And then later that evening, my brother came up to me after the function was over and said, my golly, what happened at your table? And I said, he said, well, Mrs. Someone came up to me and apologized profusely. I apologized to you. You were not insulted. I was the one that was insulted. Oh, you got to put that away, babe. Just ignore that kind of stuff. I'm like, why would she apologize? That just figures. She apologized to him, my brother keeper. All right. So that's where it's all at. That wasn't the only time the Mormonism in the West, rather uncomfortably. I ran for office in 90, in California. I ran for the treasurer of the state. And Pat Robertson and I were pretty good friends because I'd gotten to know him during the Reagan years. And so I asked him, the Christian community in Orange County is huge. And so I asked him if he would endorse me. And he said, I'll do anything to help you, Bay. You know how politicians are. They're never specific. They come, oh, yeah. So I called him up. I said, look, I'm going on this Christian radio show tomorrow, the biggest one in Orange County. Will you come on it? Say some nice words. He said, fine. So I'm doing the interview on the Christian radio show, and I'm running for treasurer of this, and I believe in this, and knowing they're Christians, I'm hitting those family back hard. And they said, well, we've a guest coming on here. And we've got Pat Robertson on the line. And Pat says, oh, hello, Bay, how you doing? You know, and very friendly. Great gal, gotten to know her over the years. She's going to make a terrific treasurer. Thank you very much, Pat, you know, or Mr. Robertson, whatever I was saying at the time. And then the guest, the guy who was the host said, or no, it was Pat, said, "They come from a great Catholic family, just a great Catholic family." And so I thought, well, that's accurate. I don't need to say anything. And then he repeated it. "Bay's a good old Catholic girl." And I said, "Ooh, I got a lot of Mormon friends. I got a church in this community. They are not going to talk to me if I don't clarify this." So I thought, okay, I guess I better make it clear. I said, "Well, you know, I do come from a great Catholic family. I'm, of course, a convert. I'm a Mormon." Complete silence. And they're, "Oh, okay." And they move quickly on. Well, many of you know that Christians sometimes tend to be a little anti-Mormon. The next day, this poor host had two-hour radio show call-ins. "You had a Mormon on your radio show, and you all endorsed her?" And that was 2 hours. All that anti-Mormonism. I lost so many votes over that one. That was a ridiculous. What? I mean, but I had to clarify it. I knew one of my Mormon friends would be listening to that, and I was going to be in soup, bad, deep soup if I didn't clarify that, but that's the way it goes. You know, in one final little anecdote, in Pat's 92 campaign, there was an operative, an excellent operative in Iowa that we were trying to recruit, and she had just done a heck of a job in past. And so, but she's a very active Catholic. Well, that should be fine. The candidate's Catholic and very active. And so I kept talking to her, and she said, "Can you fly out and we'll meet?" So I flew out to the Midwest, figuring we'd have a meeting at the airport. And she says, I have a special favor to ask. Will you come to me and come to my priest?" What I do for my brother. Okay. Off we go to this very holy man who's just a wonderful priest who's a real intellectual who mentors a lot of conservative Catholics. And I'm sitting down opposite him, and we get going. And all I'm trying to do is impress this woman to get her board to campaign, and I could care less about whether they're anti-Mormons or not. This is not my time to convert people. I am just trying to clearly get this woman aboard the campaign. So I kept thinking, what's the best thing? What's the best thing to do? So I just decided to listen to him. The bottom line was he decided that, you know, Mormons were not Christians, and he explained that to me, that we are not Christians, not a Christian faith. And he was bringing up the Bible and different phrases of the Bible and passages. And then he said, "You know, I'll tell you what the big problem is, Bay. In order for Marlene here to support your brother, she has to feel confident in your brother's judgment. And one wonders about a brother's judgment to be president of the United States when he chooses a Mormon to run his campaign." And I just looked at him and I said, "Him, I am not a Mormon, Father. I'm his sister." He said, "Doesn't matter. You're a Mormon." We got her aboard, but I don't know if that was worth it. I came back, I said, "Pat, don't ever ask me." But that, I don't want you to think that it's always because of Mormon. In 92, when Pat was running, there was a conservative group of men who wanted to run the campaign. They were old established, backroom dealing kind of conservative, old boy network, well established and much experienced in politics, who came to visit his home and say, "We want to run your campaign. We want to run for president, and we want to run it." And Pat had, I guess out there by this time, it was well known that I was Pat's political advisor. So Pat asked me to come in from California and be at the meeting, which I did. And I'm sitting and just listening. And they get going, what we're going to do and how we're going to do it and where we think you'll win and pick up the votes and how successful you can be. And then, Pat, there's one thing you have to know. A woman cannot run a campaign. Women are entirely too emotional. Especially when they're sisters. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, you guys, so dumb. You now have no chance of being involved in any campaign with my brother. They just completely insulted me because I was a woman. I hadn't even asked to be at the meeting. And they should know better because Pat always asked me to run his campaign, so there was nothing I could do about it. I was not threatened at all by these little turkeys. But there were times when I know you women have probably been asked or had this sometime in your life, whether you were 5 or 15 or older and wiser. Do you ever wish to be a man? Did you ever wish to be a man? I mean, I know there's times when you think, you know, if I was a man, I could have gotten that job, or I could have done this, or I could have done that. And people have said to me, do you ever wish to be a man? I said, I had no interest in being. I had 7 brothers, and I could see I had the better end of the deal. But there are a half dozen occasions when I want you to know I wanted to be a man. One time was when I was with these guys, and I wanted to beat the living daylights out of them. And I thought, what joy I would have to go outside and just clock one of them, like my brothers have done so often to people. But I could not, and that's when I really was, I said, I now know the joy that I could have. I'll have to wait till heaven to be able to accomplish this. So there are times you get in the midst of it, you think, ha-ha, oh, that's why I can't do that. But that's the situation. Now, Becky has also asked me, and I'm going to mingle this back through with the politics, how I ended up being a Mormon. As her husband says, he came, he was living out in California watching my TV show, moved back to D.C. or Virginia area and went to church and looked across and said, what's Baby Gannon doing in the aisle? What is she doing here? And raced home and looked up my, so she's a Catholic, came back and went, I don't understand, how did this work out? Well, he too thought I was a Catholic, as most people, I'm afraid, because my family is so active in the Catholic faith, from my father straight on down to my brothers, and Pat being one of the real great Catholic writers in this country, and defends his faith in the media often. So what happened to me? My father's in heaven and still asking that question. I immigrated. I was a spirited person. And for some reason, all through college, I used to tell my friends, I'm going to Australia. I am going to go to Australia when I get out of college. I'm just going to go find out. And, you know, a girl's hanging out. Then why are you going? Oh, real men in Australia, real men, you know. What the heck I was talking about. But, you know, you just, we're going to go to Australia. It's rugged there, you know. For some reason, I had this fascination with Australia. And so after I got my graduate degree and then taught for a year at my high school and felt, you know, all right, I've done this. Given back to my high school, which I thought was the greatest institution I've ever been involved in. And I said, it's time. If I'm going to do something, I've got to do it now. I can't just hope this is going to happen. So I filled out the papers, and you have to be a landed immigrant in order to go there for any length of time. You can't just go and then work. You have to have a... So I immigrated. You don't have to renounce your American citizenship or anything like that. You become a landed immigrant. So I got on the plane and flew to Australia knowing not a soul, not a single soul. And I started looking for a job and found one and became friends with the people who helped me find a job, who were headhunters. And she was Australian, he was American. And they hung out with the American consulate people. And so the next thing I know, I was meeting Americans over there. So like, that is not the purpose of this exercise. So I was trying to, you know, pull back. I'd play tennis at the consulate's home on Saturday and with this mix of Americans and Australians. And I was there 6, 7, 8 months. And they called me up and said, the consulate did, and said, we have a lonely American here who would like to play tennis with an American. And I said, what? He's a loser, I'll tell you that right off. He's in Australia and he's calling the consulate to meet an American. I mean... I agreed to do the favor. He was a Mormon. And that's where I was introduced to the church. Remember our first date? We went out. I didn't know what he described himself, and he said, come and pick you up at the house. I'll pull out front and come on out, because it's a very busy road I live on, and this is traffic time. So a car pulled out front. The one thing I forgot to mention and did not remember that evening was it also was very near the red light district. And so there was girls sometimes on the corner where I lived, like right in front of the house. So I'm, you know, we have a little gate. And so I'm like in the courtyard, kind of looking out. I'm at the door. And a car stops. The car's fine description of his car. So I'm in my little tennis whites, my little tennis racket. And I come running out to this guy's utter amazement. I open the door and get in. And I say, and he's just like, whoa, what a lucky night. And I'm like, hi, Ron. And he said, huh? I said, Ron? He said, huh? And I said, oh my God. I got out of that car and raced up those steps yelling into the house. Oh, you know, I had roommates. Well, you won't believe what I just did. So Ron finally arrived and he couldn't understand. He's like, and I was like, let me see your ID first before I'm getting in this car. And we went to play tennis. And on the tennis courts, he said, I'm a Mormon. I'm like, yeah, okay. And he said, know anything about Mormons? I said, yeah, a little state and a big temple. What about it? That was pretty much what I knew about Mormons. And I dated him for 6 months. And he introduced me. And he was an aggressive little missionary. You know, he was very proud of his mission, and he wasn't finished it. And so I had no prayer of a chance, I'll be honest. You know, every day we ended up talking about the Book of Mormon or something. I thought, my gosh, this guy's really focused on religion. But I was an active Catholic at the time. And by the end of that 6 months, I had read the Book of Mormon and was convinced that I needed to seriously consider the Mormon Church. Which was an easy step to take to even consider it, because I had about 16 years of Catholic schooling and been to church every Sunday for my first 20-some years. I think we skipped a little at college to prove that we were independent and then went back. But, and then so I learned about the Mormon Church. And then I did some serious praying, and I explained to the Lord that I couldn't just, you know, change religion. Not like somebody who's looking for religion. This was somebody who was very happy as a Catholic and understood all the culture and was comfortable with the culture of Catholicism as well. And so I explained to the Lord that we cannot just do this. It's not just do this, you know, go home and say, guess what? This is not going to work. Unless I cannot deny. I mean, that I can't talk myself out of it. I have to be absolutely certain, Lord. And while I'm very convinced that this is a very good church and very likely the true church, I'm not so certain that I'm right. Maybe this is just a whim. You know, maybe this is something, it's just kind of because I like this guy or something. You know, who knows? So I went several months thinking about it, never mentioning it to Ron. And then I said, I need to be absolutely positively certain. And I went to a regional conference in Australia, in Sydney. And I had an experience that I will never forget, where I sat there and all of a sudden, as I was praying and said, you know, I have to be absolutely certain, Lord, the feeling came from the toes and went straight up. And never since have I doubted, not even for a moment. It was complete calm in a time when I knew I was facing some very tumultuous days. But that moment, I knew I would become a Mormon. Someday, I would have to work out how, but I was going to become a Mormon. Because I knew that that's what the Lord wanted, without question. And so I flew back home, and Ronald Reagan had decided to run for president. So things work out perfectly. And I said, okay, I will work for that guy. I'd work for Nixon, not somebody more my style, let's say. So I got myself involved in the Reagan campaign when I came home. And I decided I could not, like, walk in the house after 18 months in Australia and say, hi, I'm going to become a Mormon. Now, they'll think I'm a Hare Krishna or something. You know, just, my gosh, what is she doing next? And so and don't get me wrong, I do not think for a moment that those years of thinking I should go to Australia was just by accident. Because I could never have become a Mormon in Washington, D.C. or in the U.S. Because I was too close to the family. You know, I mean, it was, you know, I couldn't see them one day. I had to really be removed. I really think that I was in Australia for a reason. I do believe that to this day. And the fact that I've never seen Ron again also tells you. I came home and I waited 2 months so that they could see I was still normal Bay. If as normal as Bay ever was, but that's where I was. And so I started working on this campaign. I lived at home deliberately, and I was there for 2 months when I explained to them that I was going to become a Mormon. That was not good. That was a rough 6 months after that. She didn't hardly talk, but Dad, he was a wonderful Christian man, and then Mom was too, but she was upset because I was upsetting Dad. And he was very, very upset because he had lived his life wanting to give his children two things. A family that was whole, because his father had looked out on him. and that he was committed to his family. Home every night, dinner every night. That's the way it was. And his faith, which is what gave him, what he thought gave him his life back. And his father, a priest came knocking on his door when he was in eighth grade, and he just graduated, or no, freshman year, and knocked on his door from Gonzaga High School right down here, and said, it was a Jesuit priest, and said, William, where are you? You're not at school. And he was in public school. He said, and his mother came to the door and said, William can't go to Catholic school because we don't have the money. And the priest said, I didn't ask you where the money was. I asked you where William was. And he went to Gonzaga High School and then to Georgetown. And he thinks that's what made him. And it was because of his faith. And he never wavered in his faith. So he wanted to instill that faith in his children. And here he has this daughter who's, it's the one gift he thought he could give that would be the most precious, and she was turning her back on it. So you can imagine he was really in pain. And I knew it, and I didn't, you know, what could you do? So he asked me if I would see a priest, which I, of course, agreed to. And he decided, he called a priest who was an old Jesuit priest. And I went down there to meet with this priest. And, oh my gosh, that was another wonderful experience. And this priest asked me all the questions. He was bringing out the scripture here and doing his best to basically tell me and explain to me that Mormonism was wrong. And, you know, he'd say, look at this phrase, Catholic's right, Mormon's wrong. This. And I explained to him, I did not know that much about the Mormon faith at this stage. I had a strong testimony of it, but I certainly wasn't about to start arguing scripture with the man. I wasn't even going to argue Catholic scripture with the man, in spite of the fact that I had 16 years, because he had about 38 years, or 42. He had a little way ahead of me. And so he kept raising it. And finally I said to him, Father, I know without a doubt that this is what my Father in heaven wants. I have no doubt of this. Would you not agree that this is what I should do? And he said, how is it that you, at your age, would have no question about what you're to do when I do not have that certainty? He's a Catholic priest, probably in his 60s, who was not certain. My heart was broken for him. And I said, I didn't want to say, well, you know, here's the Book of Mormon. So, you know, I was enormously respectful of him. And I said, I don't know that. I just know that I have an absolute conviction, certainty, that I am to become a Mormon. And that's what the Lord, my Father in heaven, wants of me. And so that's what I'm going to do. And then my sister-in-law called my mother, who they were talking back and forth, and she said, let me try it. I have a charismatic Catholic priest, see, because they might not relate to the Jesuit. We'll go charismatic. And my mother came and said, will you see a priest? Sure, I'll see a priest. Now, you have to know, I don't know any Mormons. I do not know a Mormon in the city of D.C. So it's not like I'm going to church. I don't know anybody. I'm just me. And I am off to see a charismatic priest. And we went to the ceremony. And again, I have enormous respect. These very, very committed people. But even my sister-in-law didn't know what was going on. Because she wasn't charismatic. And so we were like very nervous in this ceremony. And we talked to the priest. And again, I mean, nothing was going to change my mind. I already had my testimony, so they were not judging me. And they realized that. So then my father came and he talked to me. And I told him that I was convinced. This is what my father... I thought that if I told him that, he would relax. Because he, as a Catholic, believed that if you really think you're doing the Lord's will, then it's the right thing to do. You're not supposed to defy that. And so as a Catholic, that would put his mind at rest. Even though he might think my mind was a little, you know, fouled up at the moment, it would put him at rest. And I think it did. I hope it did. He had to wait 6 months after that, and which I did. And at 6 months, I moved out of the house and was baptized. And I didn't know anybody at the baptism except two people. An interesting story. At the convention that summer, where Reagan lost, some other guy won. Important fact is Reagan lost that one. Ford won. I was with my brother. He took me around all these people. And it was such a great time because neither of us were working it in the sense of, you know, involved heavily in one of the campaigns. I guess I had been. I was working Reagan, but I wasn't working the convention. And so he took me around in one event. You know, he had introduced me. This is John Conley Bay. This is so-and-so. This, you know, I just meeting all these wonderful people that you've been reading about. So I had this wonderful time. And one evening, he said, a group of them, old Dixon guys, were going to have a drink. And he said, hey, Bay, this one's one of you. I said, what are you talking about? This is Mormon. And so the guy came over and says, you're a Mormon? I said, not yet, but if I can survive another couple months, I'll be a Mormon. And he said, took me aside, sat with me. And he was from Utah. And his name was Barker. And he called the Coltons, who are Washington, D.C., who are the greatest people in the whole world. And the Colts called me up and had me to dinner, or, you know, dinner, Sunday dinner. And I got to know the Coltons. And every, you know, 4, 5, 6 weeks, they invite me to their homes. The Coltons now, as you probably know, are the president of the temple. But they are Sterling Colton and his wife Ellie were the only two people I had at my baptism. And because I didn't know anyone else. I didn't have anyone to invite. So that's who was there. And then they took me to dinner that night. And they were just wonderful people. And that is how I became a Mormon, which is the story Becky wanted me to tell. And so let me just close by saying, she also asked me to say, how has this impacted my life and politics? Other than the stories I've just told, were awkward. There have been positive moments. Being a Mormon is a very funny thing. You all probably had this experience, depending on, maybe you haven't, I don't know. I'm a Mormon in this midst of the Reagan convention, the Reagan campaign of 80. And I'm in the big meeting, and they're talking about women. We're not doing well with women. We're not doing, and I'm the only woman in the same staff. You're not doing well with women, and so they start giving me grief. And who speaks up for me immediately? And says, don't mess with her. I'll take care of the grief. Is Dick Worthlin. He's the bolster. He's a Mormon. And whenever they gave me grief about being a Mormon, he said, nah, bae, just ignore him. I'll take care of them. And so I always had a natural friend as a Mormon. I mean, Orrin Hatch would walk through and he'd shake hands with people at a big event and he'd give me a bear hug. And I would say, how does she know Orrin Hatch? Well, he just knows I'm a Mormon, so he gives me a bear hug. I mean, that's how it is. I mean, it's just amazing. And so I was really close to these people. I got to be close to them. I mean, how can you not be close to somebody giving you a bear hug, you know? So it happened. There was a couple of us who were Mormons. And they always came through and sat down. They just knew I was a Mormon. They'd sit down. You know, I was always in the office as treasurer. And chat. So you had a kind of a family that was created simply because you were Mormon. I mean, I was a Catholic, for heaven's sakes, for years. And I didn't have Catholics come down and sit and talk because I was a Catholic. I mean, I wouldn't think of it. And I don't blame them. I wouldn't have thought of doing it. But, you know, there is a camaraderie. And it was a wonderful, as somebody who was a convert and who knows Mormons, it was really, really a nice thing. And to this day, I'm very good friends with Orrin and Elaine, as well as Dick Worthlin and his wife. I mean, I just knew them because of the years of politics and there were so few of us in it. And so in that regard, it was a really positive experience. But I kind of think of politics as brutal. It's nasty, it's ugly, you lie, you cheat, you trash people, you tell... I mean, it is a brutal business. And it doesn't matter that you know it's a lie. If it's going to work, you say it. Because that's what the purpose is to... Not how you win, it's to win. Discuss how later. And that's it. I mean, I'd like to tell you it's different, but that's how it is. And, you know, and the person who says, you know, that is so rotten what they're doing, the press says you're a whiner. Because the press expects it to be rotten. So it is, you know, you say it's unethical, they said that. Yeah. I mean, I was running for treasurer of the United States, and the L.A. Times had an 83 piece. Treasurer Kid has bad credit rating. I'm waking up on the same morning reading, I got a what? I'm going to church, you know, kind of like with my poorest clothes on. I mean, I had no bad credit rating. So I'm thinking, did I miss something? Did some lien get against me, you know, over the years that I just didn't know about? Hasn't caught up with me? And I called all the credit bureaus. And I said, what's my rating? They said, A+, AA, whatever the top one is. You have no mark on your rating, not a mark. So they said, look, I'll do you a favor. I'll call all the others. She called back. She gave me printout. I had no mark on my credit rating. Nobody had ever asked me if I had a mark on my credit rating. No press had called and said, this is a story we're running. When I could have produced it and made it so it didn't run. So I went in and met the editorial board of the LA Times, and I threw my credit rating on the table, and I said, what is this? And they said, oh, that was a rumor that was going around for months. I said, well, I never heard the rumor. Well, your opponent was putting it out, so we finally ran the story. I said, oh, what kind of journalism is this? Oh, yeah, we're sorry, we'll run a retraction. You know, the retraction's a little thing. Somewhere buried, you know, in the one ads or something. And, you know, how many votes did I lose? I mean, who's going to vote for a treasurer of the state of California who has a bad credit rating? It was just, you know, and they did it, you know, 3 weeks before. But that's politics. They didn't want me to win. And so this was a way they could hurt me. And, you know, what the heck? So I was out there in California. I was so angry. It's another time when I just wanted to beat the living daylights out of my phone. And I said, what do I do? What do I do? You know, this is politics. You know it. You've been in it a long time. And I said, what does my brother do? Who, you know, been called every name there is. They create names for that guy. And I said, what's he do? I mean, he's been in longer than I have. He's been just trashed publicly. And I said, he laughs. He laughs. They start laughing or get out. I was out running. That's what I did to kind of calm down. I was out running and I said, that's it. Start laughing. So I tell the story of myself. You know what I mean? So I lost. Big deal. I didn't, you know, I did my best. And they did their worst. And that's the way it is. So it's very, very tough out there. So what I've always done and what I find that where my faith has been enormously supportive is when you were in high school and you took math, I don't know how many of you said, why am I doing this? What use is this? I have three teenage boys. Why would I want to study a differential equation? What good is this, Mom? I know you got a master's degree in it, but we know you never used it, so why would I do this? And it's a training. You train your mind to solve problems, and you solve them day after day after day. So when you have a real-life problem, you know you're now into, you've got all the emotions flowing, but you know what the routine is. You know what you're supposed to do to get it done. You write it all down on the paper, you look at it, and you're way ahead of somebody who just doesn't know which way to turn. It's a training. It's the same thing as Latin. You learn things. It's a logical process. And that's what we believed when we were being taught those things. And that's what justifies me making my sons take those courses. But the Mormonism is similar for me in the sense that you always know at the end of the day what you should have done. You may not have done it. You may have just reacted and then right off. But you come home that night and you go, okay, I'm moving in a direct opposition to where I should go. I'm not behaving as I should behave. And so you pull back. And so it's a constantly, it grounds you. It makes certain you don't get too far out. You don't become like them. And that is where I think the greatest strength for me was at the end of the day. You know, you go to church on Sunday and the purpose is to reflect where you are. And I go to church and you're taking the sacrament and I think, what kind of week did I have? And sometimes it's very nasty. It's very ugly. And did I participate in that? And did I enjoy it? I mean, this is... We took him out down there. We took Graham out right down there in the bayou. And I had a blast doing it. And I'm sure those guys thought what I did was unfair and unethical and everything else. I don't. I looked at it and I said, no, I think this goes. It goes. You know, but I got to live with myself. And so that is what I think, we're not perfect by any means. But I am certain of my faith. I have absolute certainty and the testimony remains as strong. And I have gone through many, many trials and often wandered away and come back. I've gone through the divorce and the death of family members where you start wondering and questioning. But there is no question in my mind that I am eternally grateful that I was introduced to this church because it is what made me today, what keeps me focused, and what keeps me grounded, and which allows me to be the kind of mom I am, so that I know for certain. And I teach those young kids, the 15-year-olds, on Sunday school and Sunday, and I say, you don't understand yet. And I know that I don't know how to tell them. What gift they have. When one young 18-year-old spoke on Sunday and said, I didn't know what college I wanted to go to, so I prayed about it. I knew what I wanted to go to, but I didn't know what I should go to. And she says, I hang out with my girlfriends and guys at school, and they say, well, this one's got pretty good academics, and maybe I want to be a nurse, and that one's pretty good at this, and they don't know. But I know what school I'm supposed to go to now because I've prayed and got my answer. What a gift that 18-year-old has, never to have to look back, never to second guess. What if, what if, what if? And all that wasted energy. So I leave you with that testimony, brothers and sisters, that this is the finest thing the thing that I did in my life that has been most beneficial to me, without question, is to become a Mormon. And I have never questioned that, and I am thrilled and all grief I get to this day from my family, because I'm the black sheep that left the church. I does not hesitate to smile about it and laugh about it and let them say what they want. I am confident and comfortable, and I have the certainty that gives you the kind of peace that is what so many millions don't have. And I regret they don't enjoy it, and I am grateful eternally that I do. And I say this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Yes. Delighted to take a couple questions. I was asked if I could, and I'd be delighted to. Ask about anything. I don't know. You know, politics is brutal. It's just as brutal. You know, I know a lot of people that got in and just got smacked upside their head and said, what am I doing? This is a really dumb idea. You know, you have to be very thick-skinned. You have to be called names, you know, and be willing to go on national television and have them just call you names. And know that it's not true and have that conviction that this is not true and what they're trying to do is silence me and I'm not going to be silenced, so let it be. And so the church is absolutely correct. We have to have our kind of people who believe as we do. I mean, I'm in a cause, and I don't care. You know, I deal with all kinds of religions. But if those people who share my views, I encourage them to become involved. The reason the liberals are so good, and I could give this tell this to the feminists on in college campuses. I speak often, and I tell the women. The reason there's so many feminists in politics is not because the Democrats opened the door and said, why don't you all come on in, we'll give you a place and give you a lot of clout. It's because other women said, we're not taking this anymore, the feminists. And they said, we got to move. And they got their women to run for school board and local races and become involved and learn what it is to be a candidate. And the next thing you know, there were legislators in the states and state senators and mayors. And so when the big year came, back there when Clinton won, you had women running in the Democratic Party for U.S. Senate and U.S. Congress and governors who had enormously good resumes. I mean, you can say, can't believe this. These were people who could compete with any man on resumes and experience, and they won. They should have won. They were really good. They don't agree with me, but they were qualified people. And so when people who are more conservative say, where are the women? I say, you know, we've got to push them. We got to get them. They took care of each other. And then the Democrats had no choice but to recognize they had clout. If we want people of our faith or of our beliefs in positions of power, you can't expect them to run when, you know, they're 52 years old. I got to take a run for governor. I mean, it doesn't happen that way. You know, and the person's been back room for 35 years and say, well, I'm smart, I'm capable, I'm better than this. You may be. But he knows all the ways. He has this organization out there. He knows how it's done. He can get a flavor. He knows that this issue is very meaningful to me, but I don't think anyone else gives a hoot about the gold standard. So I best not talk about gold standard because I think I'll put them all to sleep. I'll talk about it once I win. You know, I mean, these are things you learn. And it's like any other business. You know, you want to become, you know, in charge, run a big, you know, high-tech firm. You don't wake up at 52 and say, you know, I've never done this before, but I'm pretty smart. I think I'll do this. I mean, you learn it. And so the liberal agenda, an agenda that is very much in opposition. When I say liberal, I mean, you know, the real extreme liberal rather than just Democratic Party, is very much in opposition to our teaching. It's very much in opposition to faith. Any kind of conservative or Christian-based faith. It is direct It's in many levels, it is in purpose is to reduce the influence of those things in which we believe. Is to take that out and make them meaningless, you know, so that they don't have the kind of influence they do in today's society. And you can go from education and go right up to the education in the grade schools and the high schools and see what they're teaching, and you will see that this is not in our best interest. And you have homeschoolers bringing the kids home to make certain they're taught certain things. It may not be true in Utah, because Utah, they're probably still teaching the things we want them to be taught, but you go into these other public schools, and you're alarmed. I'm sure many of you have been there. And you see the kind of policies being passed in state legislatures, and it's shocking. It's downright shocking. And you see awful things happen, and no one be alarmed. I was on a college campus recently, and I hear that all these kids shooting each other. It's a terrible thing. I don't care. Everybody thinks it's a terrible thing. And they say, look at this 13-year-old. He shot someone. Why would he do that? Let's examine it. And I've done TV shows on it. And my position is, after you examine many of them, not all of them, but many of them, it's a daggone wonder he didn't do it before and more people aren't. I mean, you take these 13-year-old kids and the mother gets divorced and he's got high school and he's real close to his grandfather. This is a true case. Very close to his grandfather. Goes over to his grandparents' house all the time. And he's there with his mom and dad, and they get a divorce, and then the mother's has her boyfriend move in, and they decide to move. So all this happens in a year, and he doesn't see his grandfather anymore. He doesn't know anybody. He's a little overweight. Everybody's making fun of him every day. He has no friends. I mean, I've been in times when I don't know anybody, and I'm more mature, and I've had a lot of life's experiences, and it's still tough. What would I do then when I was 12 or 13? There's no place to turn. And so then they say, oh, I can't believe it. He got his friend's gun. Let's talk about the gun. What do you mean the gun? But this poor child, where were people for this child? Where were they? And that's what we want to talk about. And you just, now, I agree, we should look at the gun, but let's focus on how many of these kids, this is something they don't want to discuss. I went on a college campus recently, Miami University out there in Ohio, and I made the statement to 200 students that the best circumstances for a child is a whole family. Yeah, this is not brilliant, I'm not an education to figure this one out. And I said, it's a mom and dad in the home is without question the best environment for a child. They argued with me. They fought. I said, look, I'm a single mom. I've been a single mom since my baby's been an infant. I appreciate single moms. I know you can be successful. I'm just telling you what the best is. Argued. No, that's not true. What about this one? I was like, we got to begin at ABC. This is amazing. But that's what will fight it. They will. They justify the lifestyle that they have, and they will not stop. And so that is why it is important that we have people that speak out. That might be the lengthiest daggone answer you've ever gotten to a question. Any other? One more. Yes.
Anti-Semite,
racist, xenophobe, you name it, he's it. He's a wonderful guy. He's an absolutely terrific fellow. And what happened is he was very close when Nixon was president. He was with Nixon when he went over. Actually, it was before Nixon was president. He traveled over to Israel right after the 68 war. Was there 67, 67? So it was right before he became president, which was took office in, I guess, 69. So he became close to, and he knew a lot of the Israeli leaders and all. And then he was in the White House, and many of the ambassadors would come over, ask him what's going on. And so he developed a terrific relationship, and he was a great defender of Israel. And then what happened, he was in the Reagan administration, and now times had passed, and he'd seen what was going on in Palestine. And he took a public position that Palestine really needed self-determination. You couldn't have the little kids shooting, and this couldn't continue. And so he took a public position, and they went wild. Because here was a national figure, close to presidents, who influenced his policy that was suggesting that Palestine had, and the Arabs had, a position here. Now, many others, many of the leaders in Israel agree with them now, but it was very, very shocking. That's what began it. And he's the kind of guy that he won't back off. So he goes around telling him, yes, and he defends the Palestinians. Of course, then all the Arabs are cheering him, which doesn't matter. And you got the controversy there. But that was the beginning of where they started to call him the names. And that's the politics today is there's we call it the politics of intimidation, and this is true of many issues, of which the Jewish issue is one, and the gay issue is another, any race, affirmative action, immigration are others. And this is what they do. You take a public position like immigration, and Pat believes we have to have a tough immigration policy. Well, that's a legitimate position. You know, maybe we're not going to win, maybe you disagree, that's fine. But it deserves a public debate. It's politically incorrect. So he goes out to California and says, something's got to be done about illegal immigration. And the New York Times called him xenophobe and racist, and he hates people of color, and just was just an awful, awful attack on him. He did this in the 92 campaign. And we did it for a reason, because people had to hear it. And all of these people, I lived in California, so I knew what the response would be. They were saying, nobody's ever said this. The local candidates won't say it. Even though they're bringing drugs in and they're impacting the health and education and taking jobs, would not say it. So Pat said it. He was called every name in the book. Well, then they polled it, as Republicans and Democrats do, and it said 86% of people agreed with Pat. So Tui Einstein ran, who was really a smart politician. She came out for stronger immigration control. LA Times. She's just trying to take care of a concern of the citizens of California. So he going out there and then having the people respond allowed us to move, and we've had immigration reform since. Not that we don't still think there needs to be some, but there has been enormous reform in some regards. What they'll do is they call you names and call you names and call you names, so that even though we believe it, as a candidate, you won't say it. Because as a candidate, you can't afford to be called a racist. So why would you speak about affirmative action? And so you just don't talk about it, because you don't want to be defending yourself as a racist or an anti-Semite. You just don't get into it. So therefore, you suppress the opposition by the politics of intimidation. There's very few people who go through the firestorm to get to the other side to allow public debate. They just avoid it. They just, and the Republican Party now will tell you, they won't touch life because it's too controversial. We'll not talk about it. That's a big issue with me, is the unborn. And they say, it's too controversial, babe, too controversial. Well, let's have another 1.3 murdered this year while we worry about our politics. I mean, do we believe it or don't believe it? If you don't believe it, okay, fair enough. But if you do believe it, maybe we should do something. But they'll be called names. And so that is where they come. That is the politics. Call them anti-Semites, and the more you see it out there, people say, well, the last thing we want to do is upset the Jewish community. It's a very active group in different states, and enormously influential in the media. So let's not talk about that, even though I might think you're right. I don't want to talk about it. And that's a foreign policy issue, so that really doesn't affect many candidates. But the affirmative action, anything they can call you a racist on, they'll call you a anti-woman a lot for if you're if you're pro-life, they call you all kinds of names, and then they'll try to discourage you. So that works. One other question that I have here, or should we call it a day? Okay, sir.
I just wanted to ask you, Pat must have become rehabilitated, judging from the number of votes that he got to
take. it's very funny. We were chastised by conservatives for stating the day after Election Day that they weren't our votes. They were calling us, I was on radio show, I never had a candidate who got votes and said they weren't his. What is this? I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, we're honest. They're not our votes. I'm sorry we have to tell you this. And I said, look, it's not that they should be taken away from us, because once a person votes, you don't get a re-vote because you made a mistake. But they weren't our votes. I mean, that's simple. And we have 100 different stories on that, but as he said, we took 4 states from Bush, and he did it once he realized that we weren't going to be able to have a third party. It was just not going to be something that would sell in this country. He didn't want Gore to win. If he thought we could have real influence in the third party, then we could build something. But he said, I took 4 states away from Bush because of my vote, and then I took 1 away from Gore. And Bush won. Thanks, Stuart. Thank you all very, very much. Enjoy the next one.
I guess that leaves us about 5 minutes until our next session. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.